Hello, lovers.
My name is Alex.
And I'm Helena.
And you are listening to Generation Loveless,
a weekly podcast where we discuss the trials and tribulations of love in an internet-obsessed world.
We share our stories of bad Tinder dates, sexual awakenings, self-care, heartbreak and healing, and everything in between. So join us on this roller coaster of dating in the millennial age because it is one wild ride.
And we want to hear from you. Send us your stories, questions, and opinions. You can either send us a DM on Instagram at generation.loveless or shoot us an email at generationloveless@gmail.com. All right, let's dive into this week's episode.
Hey guys, so this is maybe take three for us only because Helena and Alex are in super giggle mode.
I keep laughing hysterically to the point where I can't breathe and...
And then I can see her in the corner of my eye giggling.
I could feel you seeing me. And that made me laugh more.
Well, welcome back. Here we are. This is episode 8 and we are exploring why millennials are afraid of commitment. Do you think we're afraid of commitment, Helena? What do you think about this?
Yeah, I do think we're afraid of commitment. I think that from what I've seen, it's like we have one foot in, one foot out at all times. People are afraid to be the first one to... No, wait, hold on. Let me rephrase this. I feel like people are afraid that the other person's going to leave. So everyone's sort of always on the defense. Is that the right one?
Yeah.
On the defense, not on the offense.
On the... defense.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm trying
to
say.
Sports is
not my
thing.
I don't know sports. So.
Thank God we're not a sports podcast.
We'd be like talking about baseball and we'd be like, touchdown.
See, this is what I'm talking about. Super giggle mode.
You guys are going to be like, shut the fuck up.
Okay.
Unless it's really funny. Also, can I just say, shout out to our international listeners.
I know, that's so cool.
We found out that we have listeners right now in the Philippines, in China, in
Sweden.
We have listeners in the UK, obviously Ireland, but we knew that from the get-go.
South Korea. Very cool. I don't know how it's getting out there, but...
I love it.
Yeah. Shout out to you guys. Thanks for listening.
To come back to your question, which we've gone really far away from at this stage. Yeah, I think we're fucking scared shitless.
Okay. Well, I am going to talk about this article that I found from the Huffington Post.
It's okay, Alex. You got this.
Giggles. Okay. It's by Mary Pitchard. And she believes that today we are more connected, however we are less committed than ever before. And her reasons are, she breaks down three of them: social media, divorce rates, and also the fact that Generation Y, we love flexibility. So I just want to go through these and kind of talk about what she talked about, and I'm sure you can relate to a lot of these. Social media, basically it's making us sad and lonely, which is depressing. I mean, it's not funny, but sometimes it makes me giggle because I feel like the joke's on us and we think that we're more connected, but actually we're just making ourselves lonely and depressed.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny in a dark, twisted, fucked up sort of way, but I guess if that's your humor, Alex.
I guess it is. Anyways, she added a recent study in this article that was commissioned by...
Badu.
I don't know what that is, but it was commissioned by Badu, and it reported that 39% of Americans spend more time socializing online than in person, and one-third are increasingly lonely because of it, along with increases in loneliness. Sorry, I thought you were smiling. I thought you were giggling.
No, your radar's extra acute right now.
I'm sorry. So, along with increases in loneliness, mental health experts are reporting increases in depression and other psychological issues. So we've basically created a vicious cycle with social media, is what she says. Ready for it? Social media is linked to loneliness. Loneliness is linked to depression. And depression is linked to the likelihood that people will close themselves off for fear of rejection, which is then linked to loneliness and symptoms of depression. So this is a really terrible cycle that we're in.
I know. And I mean, in the study, she was sort of or in the article, I should say, she was sort of saying we've created. I want to say something. Do you think that's our fault?
No, actually, that's a really great point.
Because I'm kind of like, can someone stop blaming them? This no, is me. I'm like an advocate for millennials.
Same. No, but you're kind of right here.
Can we stop blaming the millennials for things that aren't necessarily our fault? We weren't the ones who create, well, actually.
Well,
were we the ones who created?
Kind
How
of.
How old is Mark Zuckerberg?
He's included. He's definitely born after 1980.
Oh, yeah. All right.
I would think so.
All right. Take it back.
Yes, but no, because a lot of these things were out of our control. I didn't ask to be raised on the internet.
I didn't ask to be born mom. God, mom.
Oh, my God. But okay. Really, I didn't, you know, I think that a lot of these things, especially when you're young, especially when you're an adolescent, it's hard to monitor yourself
it's
and have full awareness of what these effects are of social media.
It's
and how
so
it's
confusing.
Impacting your social life.
Yeah.
And they're addicting. They're meant
they're
to
so
get us
addictive.
On there all the time.
It's so confusing. And it's even worse for kids nowadays. I've mentioned it before. I have a 14-year-old brother, and I think that for his generation, it's just such a part of their life. And he's in eighth grade. And when I was in eighth grade, we had MySpace, but it's like you came home and you logged on to MySpace. I know. Shout out to MySpace.
Yeah, love
Shout
you.
Out to Tom, first MySpace friend. I don't know why I put that voice on. But anyways, so we came home from school and from our activities, and then you log on to your computer. Whereas now, it's in the palm of your hands 24/7.
It's constant. It's a part of your presence.
Yeah.
That's scary.
How does that affect development of a 14-year-old?
Right, especially when you're trying to socialize and connect with someone.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, too, because my little brother, my entire family, I have three brothers, and we've all loved reading. We all grew up reading Harry Potter, just reading so much Lord of the Rings. My entire family, my mom, my dad, and my two older brothers and I. Michael, who's 8 years younger than me and 10 and 14 years younger than my other older brothers. This is a math equation now. But anyways, he's a lot younger than us, basically, is what I'm saying. And he doesn't like reading. He's the only person in our family who doesn't like reading. And he also doesn't like watching movies. And it's an attention span thing.
Dang.
Isn't that crazy?
I can slightly relate to that. I want to ask you this because I was more like Michael. But that being said, I spent a lot of time on the internet at a really young age. Like, I was never monitored on the computer.
Neither was I.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that has to do with some other things that we'll maybe talk about in a later episode.
And I mean, also, you can't prove what the causation is.
Right.
We can prove correlation, but not a causation.
True. Well, I mean, what we're talking about here is basically what Mary Pitcher talks about. And she just feels like because social media, you know, it's increased this online connection, but actually it's made us feel less connected to each other. Therefore, we have a harder time committing to each other.
Can I say something?
Of course.
Going back to my brother. Also, shout out, Michael, if you're listening, but I doubt you are because we say explicit things in this and he doesn't like listening to his older sister say that. But anyways, one thing that I noticed is that he has these massive group chats with his friends. Massive. I'm talking upwards of 30 people
what?
On Snapchat. Yeah, they don't talk
oh
on text.
God.
They talk on Snapchat. And they're constantly, constantly talking. Girls, guys, co-ed groups of 30 to 50 people maybe even. And they're talking all the time. So it's kind of, you think that these are his close friends. He sees regularly maybe three of those people in that group chat. So it's kind of reminding me of this whole, oh, we're connecting online. But that's not, you don't even fucking know those people.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
That's so bizarre to think about.
Well, right. And how are we supposed to trust people, form really intimate relationships?
You're not.
And commit with people if those are the types of relationships that we're working on all the time.
Because you're not really being vulnerable, I think, in those conversations, most of the time in those sort of surface level internet conversations, kind of mm-hmm. what you were saying about making connections, trusting people, that's based off of vulnerability.
Of course.
Yeah, so I don't know.
It's scary.
Yeah.
It is. And Pitchard also adds that we have this fear of missing out with not just social media and seeing other people doing fun things and we have FOMO, but it actually has to do with the fact that we feel like we have endless options because there's so many people online, and therefore we get FOMO if we actually choose to commit to someone.
I can see that, and I can also see how it's problematic or an issue that you can see all of your exes or even just people that you were sort of casual with but kind of had a crush on or whatever. You can see once they get into relationships, and you can basically track the trajectory of their relationship depending on how much they post on social media. I get really sad about that. I see someone that I liked or had a crush on post pictures with a new bae, and I just obsess. I want to know all about that person.
Yeah.
I'm creepy like that, though. I'm like, oh, wow, she's amazing. Now I want to learn about her. And then I, like, stalk her on social media and...
Yeah, okay. I don't like... yeah, anyways, I don't like how our generation does that. And it's more common, and it's the norm.
Well, it's not... Right. It's not that it's more common. It's that we didn't have that option before.
True.
Before, say you broke up with someone, then they moved to Iceland... And you were here in Boston, and you would just never know. You would never know if they were in a relationship with someone. You'd never have to fucking see their pictures.
Isn't that way better?
Yes, it's way better.
Yeah, I mean, we...
Go ahead.
Well, don't we... We have an episode that's coming up, and we're going to talk about this whole subject and really explore social media and breakups, because I think this is really interesting. And I also think it has to do with... You know, for me, when I'm actually in a relationship with someone, I don't post that much stuff.
Yeah, I do.
About being in a relationship online. But I think these topics are important, and we'll definitely get to them in a later episode.
Stay tuned, listeners.
Yes. So back to why we're afraid of commitment. The next thing that she talks about is that Gen Y loves flexibility in life. She says, in a society where 50% of first marriages end in divorce and today's newest retirees changed jobs 11 times on average during their lifetime, it's no wonder that today's young adults seem to be commitment phobic. I also did a little more research on this and found an interesting statistic that was from the United States Census Bureau, and it found that between 2007 and 2012, millennials accounted for about 24% of the total population of the U.S., however, they made up over 43% of all movers.
Movers as in movers and shakers, or as in movers?
Movers and shakers.
Movers,
no,
we were moving to a new city from, that's what that means?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's we crazy. Love to move. We love the flexibility. And I could actually really relate to this more so in the way that I've been in a place, you know, going to school in Boston. I knew that I wasn't going to stay in Boston when I finished college. I also knew that I wanted to move far away, either to New York or California. That's where I'm going to go. But I was dating someone, and for me, it didn't even occur to me that, like, this is a problem for some people, just knowing that I wasn't going to be around town for very long, and it kind of upset them.
Like, why would you get committed to someone who you know is leaving?
Right, exactly.
Why would you would probably put a wall up so that you don't form those deep feelings for that person. That's what I would do. I'd be scared.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Unfortunately, some of these people didn't put that wall up, and it was more like, maybe this could work.
Maybe she'll change her mind.
Right, but for me, I was, you know, I knew that I didn't want to commit to anyone.
Yeah.
What are you looking for?
My phone, because I want to talk about that example from our Instagram DM messages.
Yes.
Oh, okay, I found it. So you guys know that we ask you every week to send us DMs if you have something that you want us to talk about or if you have a comment on any of our previous episodes. I want to talk about this DM message we got from someone that I know, and he said he wanted us to talk about long-distance relationships post-grad life. Are they worth it? Under what circumstance? What does it take to make it work? I don't know if he wants us to include all this personal
maybe
stuff. He's basically saying... certainly not everyone should stay together if someone is going to teach in Thailand and the other is working in an office job in New York City. Yet it's so much easier to stay in a relationship that is uncomfortable, I think he means comfortable, than it is to break it off. Well, basically, let me just summarize what he's saying. He's basically asking kind of when we are so flexible as a generation, we want to move around a lot and we want to do those adventurous things, what does that mean for our relationships? If you're in a serious relationship with someone and you want to move... Do you stay with them? Or is that a breakup? And if that's a breakup, then doesn't that make you not want to date these people who are in these life transitions?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to date me right now.
I wouldn't want to date me right now either.
Unless someone was looking for someone to just have a honest, fun connection with and maybe have some good sex.
I know. That's the only time that I think it's good is when you know it's very temporary and you don't have, you can manage your expectations.
On both parts, ends.
But that's so difficult. That is
hard. Yeah, it's hard to find that equal, what's the word I'm looking for?
Reciprocation, same feelings.
Yeah, exactly. People are both motivated in that way.
And what would you say to him? What would you say to his questions? What should you say together in that situation? Someone's going to Thailand, the other's staying in New York City.
Well, I don't know if I agree that it's more comfortable to stay with that person. And I think it really, that depends on relationship to relationship. If there is a relationship and the two parties are very much in love and want to do long distance.
In a healthy way.
Yeah, it will happen. I have, you know, people that I'm close to that I know, and they've been in a long distance relationship for the majority of their relationship because he's a scientist. Mm-hmm. And so he's had to travel basically all over the world, and she's been here in Boston in grad school.
Oh, wow.
And they've made it work the whole time. And so I think if it's not working, there's probably a reason for that.
And I think it's maturity level as well, and also what you want in terms of a future with that person. Because I think now, at this age, maybe I'd be able to do long distance. But when I was younger, I could not do long distance. I would cheat. Mm. Because I don't know if I was immature or if the relationship was really unhealthy or I just had a really high sex drive. I don't know. But I would get to this point where I was like, fuck this. And then I'd meet someone and I'd be like,
Yeah.
It's terrible. I'm not saying it's good, but that's what sometimes that happens very commonly in long distance relationships. And I think, yeah, you have to take a good, hard look at your particular situation and be honest with yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, back to the article, what Pitchard is saying too is that as millennials as a whole, we value individualism. Exactly. So we are very oriented in our own career goals and where we want to live and this and that. And, like, relationships aren't a part of those decisions. Sometimes, of course, they are for people. But that's not really what our focus is on.
That's fascinating because I think you're so right. I think, and this applies to both genders, I think, now, too. We're all sort of saying, okay, I want to do this. What's my life going to look like? I feel like there used to be a lot more compromise in terms of relationships.
Yeah, which actually leads me to her next point, which has to do with divorce rates. And I'm not going to get, you know, super into this because we have tackled divorce in a previous episode. But, you know, growing up, we always heard, and we're still hearing that, about half of marriages end in divorce. And of course, that's going to cause millennials to feel afraid to commit to someone.
Yep.
We've been the children of parents who have gotten a divorce. I know for me, that's my case. However, I've also seen most of my friends' parents go through a divorce.
Yeah.
So, you know, the trauma that comes with that and being a part of a broken home, it scares me out of committing to someone.
Yeah.
Do you ever think of that?
Yes. Yes. Literally all the time.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I know. Well, I want to get to this next question, which Pitchard did not bring up this. This is from a different article that I read. But maybe this isn't a commitment issue with millennials. According to historian Stephanie Kuntz, she claims that with the rise of birth control, household technology, and women in the workforce, marriage has become less about economics and more about love.
Mm.
So, you know, is this a commitment issue, or is it actually that we're just maybe taking more time to choose a partner, being more careful about the choices that we're making? And I really love this quote. I'm just going to read it. It's from a Times article that was called The Beta Marriage. And the article was How Millennials Approach I Do. And this is by Jessica Bennett. So I love this. She says, "It began with a platform migration, a cross-country move, and a bandwidth challenge, cohabitation in a 450-square-foot apartment. There was a false start, botched marriage proposal, then an emergency de-glitching, couples therapy. We tried to take the product public before we were ready. I wrote about our relationship in Newsweek. And then, finally, we abandoned launch. There was simply too many bugs. It's a joke, kind of, except that when it comes to millennials and marriage, the beta test may be par for the course. And really, why wouldn't it be? For a generation reared on technology, overwhelmed by choice, feedback, and constant FOMO, isn't testing a marriage like we test a username simply, well, logical.
Wow.
Yeah, what do you think about this, Selena?
I'm just thinking about the whole point about us marrying for love, right? As opposed to marrying for more practical reasons. And I was thinking about the fact that when someone does marry for economic reasons or what have you, survival to some extent, we're really judgmental about that. But I was also wondering, when we marry for love, does that actually increase our rate of divorce or resentment and unhappiness down the line because we have unrealistic expectations of what love looks like in the long term? I'm just playing my own devil's advocate in my head because I definitely believe in marrying for love, obviously. But I'm just wondering, is marrying for practical reasons, is that actually potentially a more long-lasting system?
Well, it could be, but are people happy, really?
I don't know.
I don't think so, and that's why there was such a divorce boom.
But that divorce boom, to some extent, happened when people were starting to marry for love.
True.
Because in previous centuries, people were set up based on their parents. What's that called? An arranged marriage.
Yep.
And, yeah, I don't know. There was a lot more of that in previous centuries. If anything, in the last century, it was one of the first times, at least in our country. I mean, there's other places in the world where this is obviously still very relevant.
Right. Well, especially after, like, the first wave of, like, the feminist movement.
Right.
I mean, I think that it's also, I just want to bring this up, it's actually a myth that divorce rates right now are still on the boom. They're actually in decline.
Okay.
And that's because we're getting married less.
Okay.
Or that's what, you know, a lot of studies claim. It's not because people are necessarily happier in their marriages. It's that, again, like, we're not choosing to commit to people. Marry. Therefore, our divorce rates are down because less people are getting married.
My mom also told me that birth rates are down. Wow. Because of millennials.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah,
I'm afraid about this world getting overpopulated. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
So in the Times article, they also include a survey conducted on 1,000 millennials, and they reported that 43% would support a marriage model that involved a 2-year trial, at which point the union could be either formalized or dissolved. No divorce or paperwork required.
Wow.
I don't think that's a terrible idea.
I would do that.
I mean, for me, if I get into a serious relationship or the next serious relationship I get into, I'm not going to – I don't want to get married for a long time.
Me neither.
I want to be with someone for, God, at least 5 years.
There's an anthropologist that I love, Helen Fisher. She has some really incredible talks on YouTube, you guys, if you want to check them out. But something that I remember she said because I took notes on it, and I take notes on this type of thing because I'm scared of my own relationships. Mm. But one of the things she said was give a relationship a 2 solid year period before you decide to get married. That way you have a decent amount of seasons and changes in circumstance to be able to observe how your partner reacts to certain situations, for example. So if you were with someone and for the first 6 months, nothing really bad happened in their life, they might be acting a certain way that's actually not what they would act like if something tragic happened or if something
bumpy happened. Right, what happens when life actually starts happening?
Exactly.
Someone dies, you know, there's a crisis.
You're out of the honeymoon phase and real life happens. And what if they turn into a crazy angry person who screams at you? Is that who you want to be with? You will not know those things unless you are with them for a really decent amount of time.
Right. How do you know, like, their full emotional capacity without actually having them go through experiences that bring that up, that requires them to have a certain level of maturity and be able to communicate how they're feeling.
Yeah.
Some people are really bad at that. However, they seem like really happy, easygoing people.
Yeah.
So
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've been friends for almost 2 years. I feel like it's taken I had an idea of who you were right away, but we've really gotten to know each other over the past even 6 months.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
I actually think that I'm happy millennials feel that way.
Yeah, and so to wrap this up, do you think we're, you know, afraid of commitment, or do you think it's just that we're choosing wisely?
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I think we are afraid of commitment, but rightfully so.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a bad thing that we're getting married later or not getting married as much
or not
having children as much.
Having a child with someone we barely know. Not having a child with someone we met 8 months ago.
Right.
I think that that's actually a scary thing, and I've seen it in my own family, where you get married and you're financially tied to this person, and you're tied, once you have a baby, you're tied to them for life. And if that person's insane and they show their true colors a year after you know them and you already have a baby on the way, well, guess what? They're in your life forever.
Yeah, and then the child
then, like, has their genetics.
Right, exactly. Well, not only that, but
I know. Then I know.
The child's life is also, like, impacted. Like,
exactly.
You know, so this is all really important stuff.
I feel really good about our generation after this. We really saw the positives in this, and I just want to say, millennials, I support you.
Yeah, we're doing good. It's good to gather all the information that we can get, continue to investigate things, question things.
Helena and Alex, a voice for millennials.
Yeah. And are we the generation Loveless? I don't think we are.
Well,
we'll always continue.
There's so much more in the conversation.
Yeah, untangle that.
But I'm really glad we had this this talk.
Glad we had this talk with y'all.
I'm really glad we had this talk,
Love
Alex.
You. great.
Hit us up.
Catch you next time.
At generation.loveless on Insta, generationloveless@gmail.com. Let us know what you think.
Ask us questions.
Tell us if you're a commitment phobe.
Yeah, we want to know.
Love you guys.
We love you.
Bye.